this evening's talk is on giving and receiving, the practice of generosity. May you know of Venerable Mahagosananda, or may have heard of him. His name, Mahagosananda, translates as Maha, which means great, and Gosananda, which translates as the sound of bliss. And he's, over his lifetime, often was fondly called Maha. That's from Cambodia, and is considered the patriarch of Cambodian Buddhism. And he's probably best known for the Dhamma Yatras, the long step-by-step walks that he organized and participated in, the walks for peace through the Cambodian countryside villages and the refugee camps during and at the end and after the Vietnam War. This year, a few months ago, and he was approximately, we don't know exactly what his age was, but somewhere around 94 years old. And he had been a monk for approximately 80 years. He became a monk when he was 14 years old, as far as we know. Sananda was an incredibly glowing and light in the energy that he emitted from his being, very amazingly glowing and light person. He felt like one of the purest and one of the lightest beings that I've ever encountered. So simple, so unpretentious, so rare, really. A being with really a truly unfettered mind and a pure heart. A few years ago, I had the great honor, of teaching a 3-day weekend with Venerable Gosananda in Creston, Colorado. And during that time, a very sweet and deep connection came to pass between us. The evening before the retreat began, I was taken into his quarters, his room, to say hello. We didn't really know each other very well, and we hadn't seen each other for over a year. So I didn't know if he would remember me. And being such an old man, there were some things that he didn't remember. So I recalled to him the last time that we had met, and I asked him if he remembered me. And he responded by saying, "Oh yes, I remember your nose." And I did just what you're all doing, what I'm doing again. I burst out laughing. And I said, "Well, it must be quite a nose." And he said very, very directly and very sweetly, he said, "It's a good nose." Venerable Gosananda lived at a monastery, a temple, Cambodian Buddhist temple, that wasn't very far, about an hour's drive away from the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. He lived there for a number of years. And one particular, after teaching or during teaching one particular 3-month retreat at IMS, and not too long after the Colorado retreat happened that I taught with him, I went to visit him at the Cambodian temple. I felt like I was going to see my Dhamma grandfather, who used to call me Mum. And I asked him at one point why he called me Mum, because I'm so much older than him. Oh, he's so much older than me. I'm not so much older than him. But he responded by saying that we have all been each other's mothers at some point, and so you're Mum. So that afternoon when I went to visit him, Mum and grandfather sat and drank tea and talked and laughed. We talked a little bit about his life history. And we talked about the three-month retreat that I was one of the teachers for, and how everyone was so diligently practicing. And mostly he and I talked about the Buddha Dhamma, which was the subject that was his favorite. Being with Venerable Mahagosananda was always a most precious gift that opened and lightened the mind, open and lightened the heart. And a gift that he so selflessly and so simply offered through his being, or maybe more accurately, a gift that he offered by just simply being. And I found it quite amazing and often surprising that when I was with him, and then afterwards, my heart would feel like it filled up my whole body, my whole being, and then on out. And a feeling which often would continue on beyond our time together. That afternoon, when I left the Cambodian temple, to my total surprise, I went out to my car to drive away, and two monks and one of the nuns that lived there at the temple with Maha were filling the back seat of my car with huge bags of Thai rice and big tins of jasmine tea and sacks of sugar for me to take back to IMS for all of the yogis who were practicing during the three-month retreat. They wanted to offer some support because they were so happy that people were practicing the Dhamma. This evening, I'd like to explore this particular quality of heart, this particular quality of mind, generosity. And along with metta, upekkha, compassion, it really offers a special, and mindfulness of course, it really offers, it holds a special place for us, holds a special opportunity for us. As we take our practice out of the retreat setting and into the world of our daily life. Over 2,500 years ago now, it was really out of a boundless generosity, a profound boundless generosity, that that Gautama Buddha offered the teachings and the practices of liberation, directly out of his own experience. It's really because of the Buddha's heart, mind of great compassion and boundless generosity that we're sitting here together this evening. From a recent story about Venerable Mahagosananda to a very old story, an ancient Buddhist legend that's a tale about generosity, about compassion, with a good sprinkle of samvega thrown in. Samvega is the Pali word that translates as a strong sense of urgency to awaken. Legend that many Mahakalpas and world cycles ago, which is a long time ago, before our Buddha, Buddha Gautama, came to be, another Buddha, Dipankara Buddha, was to pay a visit to a small village in India, the village of Amaravati. And he was to offer an evening of public talks, revealing his Dharma. The villagers were very excited and felt very deeply honored that Buddha Dipankara was going to be coming to their village. So to show their great respect for the Buddha Dipankara, they decided to level the whole length of the road that the Buddha would be walking on through their village, and then to cover it with a piece of very fine cloth. In the forest just outside this village of Amaravati lived a young man who was blessed with much goodness, physical beauty, intelligence, friendliness, kindness, and a great deal of moral energy, vigor. He was the hermit Sumedha, who in a much later life was to be the Buddha, Gautama Buddha, our Buddha. Sumedha's parents were wealthy Brahmins, and they had died just a few years before, leaving this young man with 7 generations of accumulated wealth and property. It's said that young Sumedha thought, my family has amassed much wealth, and neither my parents nor any of my ancestors were able to take it with them upon leaving this world. So what's the point of amassing more, he thought. One day I too will die. As there's a road that leads beyond suffering in this world, should I remain idle? And he said to himself, no, I'll leave this sheltered life and become an ascetic and find the way. So he announced his intention to the king, and he gave all of his money to the poor, and he entered into the forest life of a hermit. He ate wild fruit, and he wore clothes made of bark, and let his hair grow long and matted. And he practiced very energetically, whether standing, sitting, lying down, walking. Within a short time, he gained a very profound insight into the true nature of things. And he bore a very bright wisdom, which was never to be dimmed. He sat for many days, blissfully absorbed in his newly found sense of freedom and understanding. On the day that Dipankara Buddha was going to be visiting the village, Sumedha was roused out of his deep meditation by all the excitement, all the activity in the town, in the village. And it's said that seated cross-legged, he rose up into the air and flew through the forest until he came to the road. And he said, what's all the excitement? Why are you working in the midday heat? Why is this road being leveled and covered with a golden cloth? And the workman replied, Venerable Sumedha, don't you know? The Buddha Dipankara is approaching the village. Well, Sumedha's heart just leapt with joy. A Buddha, he thought. Rare is it even to hear the word Buddha. Rare beyond all comprehending to meet such a fully realized one. And so he immediately came down from his airy perch and offered to help the workmen with the road. And he picked a particularly wet, low, swampy stretch of ground to fill in. And he worked with his heart and his mind, filled with light, filled with joy, and repeating over and over to himself, a Buddha, a Buddha, a Buddha. But before he was able to finish the task that he'd set for himself, he heard exquisite music and chanting and saw flowers being tossed into the air. The Buddha Dipankara was approaching. Sumedha saw multi-hued rays of light extending out from the Buddha Dipankara and a great golden light surrounding him. And then he thought, here's one who's attained all wisdom. Here's one free from all greed, ill will, and ego delusion. One in whom all goodness has been realized. I shall make an offering to the Buddha Dipankara in honor of all that he is. And so Sumedha spread his bark cloth cape over the soft, wet ground that he hadn't finished filling in. And then he lay down on top of it. And he loosened his long, matted hair and spread it out all as much as he could. And he made a passage of himself for the Buddha Dipankara to walk on so he wouldn't have to walk in the mud. And then he thought, like the Buddha Dipankara, I want to help all beings. I am determined. Despite all the difficulties, despite all the danger, I'll never turn back. I'm resolved. I'm deeply resolved to attain what the Buddha Dipankara has attained and to benefit all beings. Well, the next moment, the Buddha Dipankara arrived right at that spot. And looking down at Sumedha, he knew this hermit has made the resolve to be a Buddha. He'll be successful. In many mahakalpas and many world cycles from now, he'll be a fully realized one, an awakened one. A Buddha, and his name will be Gautama. And then out loud, surrounded by hundreds of people, monks, nuns, laypersons, women, men, children, the Buddha stated out loud, in many mahakalpas and world cycles from now, this hermit lying here will fulfill his great vow. He'll be a Buddha named Gautama. When he's a young man, he will see the four signs: old age, sickness, death, and a monk. And he'll leave his ordinary life in search of the deepest truths. And after great exertions and near death, he'll receive a life-saving meal of milk rice. And then with renewed strength and renewed energy, he'll go to the foot of a bo tree, sit himself down, and continuing his effort with great diligence, he'll attain supreme Buddhahood. Well, as you can imagine, Sumedha, lying there in the mud, became delirious with joy. My deepest wish shall be attained. I shall be a Buddha. And the next moment then, the hermit Sumedha raised his hands, put his palms together, honoring the Buddha Dipankara, as the Buddha Dipankara did back in return to him. And then the Buddha continued on his way through the village, accompanied by hundreds of followers, people from all walks of life. The Bodhisattva Sumedha arose from his bed of generosity and filled with great joy and strength of purpose, he rose up into the air and returned to his forest retreat, where he remained working hard towards his goal. So generosity. Generosity deepening as a quality of being. Generosity as a practice. We usually think of it as the practice of offering. But in its fullness, it's really both offering and receiving. A process which very clearly helps purify and transform the contraction of separateness that's engendered by self-centeredness. the developing and deepening of the heart of generosity, of the qualities of generosity, offers us the possibility of the purification and transformation of greed, clinging, stinginess, hoarding, saving, and the development and deepening of generosity offers us the possibility of the purification and transformation of the fear and the attachment that's so closely linked to the energies of resistance, to the energy of greed. Generosity, a perfectly natural aspect of our humanness, and universally recognized as one of the most basic human virtues. We offer, we give help, we receive. It's the seamless circle of generosity. Just as the Bodhisattva Sumedha, so diligently and deeply practiced, cultivated and manifested generosity, we also cultivated and we also manifested in a thousand different ways, no matter our culture, no matter our age, no matter who we are. Years ago, early one summer morning, I'm weeding and planting my garden. And my 2.5-year-old son wanders over to my work area. And with a very big, bright smile on his face, thrusts a bunch of bright yellow dandelions. I don't know how to say dandelions in Hebrew, but yellow flowers. He thrusts them at me with this big smile on his face, and I receive them with great delight, with a heart full of gratitude. I happened to be in China during my 46th birthday. The friend that I was traveling with and I were staying in Shanghai in a two-room apartment with a Chinese family. It was their apartment, and they were good friends of my friend. The 20-year-old daughter of the family had been admiring my favorite bracelet that I was wearing. And I learned that in China, the custom is to give gifts on one's birthday. So, in the midst of experiencing some degree of attachment, I decided to give my bracelet to this young woman for my birthday, though actually feeling kind of like a one-handed giver in this process of considering the possibility of doing this and then finally deciding to do it. Although by the time it came to actually give her the gift, it was with two hands and an open heart. And it was a joy at that point. But the process of getting there was very much a practice of generosity for me. A friend of mine waited some years for all of the conditions to come together to allow her to sit a three-month retreat at the Insight Meditation Society. And finally they do. They all come together, the conditions. But 1 week before the retreat begins, she calls to tell me that she's given up her spot because a very dear friend of hers who was dying of cancer had asked her if she might consider being her caretaker. Cab driver in Thailand. He and I have a very inspiring conversation about Buddhism as he's driving me somewhere in his cab, taxi cab. And just as I'm about to get out of his taxi, he takes this small bronze statue of his beloved Buddhist teacher off the dashboard of his car and hands it to me, gives it to me. And I hesitate. I hesitate momentarily, not sure how to, or even if I really can, accept this gift. And then my heart very simply opens, and it's easy to accept this really purity of generosity from this young man. 6-year-old Native American child from the Iroquois tribe sits in the middle of a circle, surrounded by many blood relatives and extended family. And in the circle with this child, there are delicious foods and beautiful clothing and blankets, and they're close to the child. After eating and drinking her fill and exploring the clothing and the blankets, a voice comes from outside of the circle. A voice calls, "I'm hungry." And then another voice from outside the circle calls, "I'm thirsty." And another voice calling, "I'm cold." And the child is led out of the circle to share the food and the drink with the hungry and the thirsty, and the blankets with the cold one. A ceremony, a training of the heart towards compassionate generosity. Summers ago now, forest fires raged in the mountains not far from where I live in New Mexico, and hundreds of individuals and families were evacuated from their homes. Almost immediately, there was an enormous outpouring of generosity coming from miles around. Clothing, food, all of the ordinary daily needs of life, offers of housing. So much offered freely that at some point we were told that it was time to stop giving. The needs of all of those suffering because of the fires had been met with great abundance. You probably read or saw on the news and on the television when the September 11th tragedy happened in New York City. You may have read or seen that there was an incredible outpouring of compassion and generosity from many, many people on many, many levels throughout the country. And the same thing happened during the tsunami. In person to person, many, many people, many organizations, human beings offering help. People to people offering from the heart. At some point during this past year, you decided you might want to come to this retreat. And you might want to be going to some other retreat. And you decide, yes, you do want to. All of the conditions come together. And you give yourself the gift, the great gift of the Dhamma, and come to retreat, to practice. For just a moment, imagine yourself standing outside your house each morning, holding a large bowl of food. A line of saffron-robed monks are moving slowly, moving gracefully down the road. And each of them is holding a begging bowl. And as they pass in front of you, as you're standing in front of your house, you scoop out a portion of the food from your bowl and put it into each of the monks' bowls. Imagine yourself as a child, standing with your mother or your father or an older sister or an older brother, an aunt or an uncle, and seeing this ritual, this offering every morning of your life, taking in the power of the generous and compassionate heart, so clearly present in this daily practice, taking in the joy and the genuine happiness that's really quite apparent in the purity of this giving every day, the benefits of generosity easily learned each day, and they become a natural part of your life. The Buddha taught, if you knew what I knew about generosity, you wouldn't let one meal go by without sharing it. The Buddha and his nuns and monks all lived in the same simple way, making alms rounds each day for their sustenance, for their food. The Buddha taught and lived what we could call a way of life. And in speaking to his Sangha, he said, "Thus you must train yourselves. We will be thankful and grateful. Not even the least thing that is done for us shall be forgotten." So giving and receiving, the practice of the heart. Most people here in Israel, as well as in the U.S., don't have this kind of daily experience, this reminder. We don't have the monastic training of the begging bowl. It isn't easily available in this country or in the U.S., which at least in part is the process of an ongoing cultivation of gratitude, an ongoing cultivation of the understanding of interdependence that's directly related to the process of receiving what is offered in support of the of life, really, of, in this case, monastic life. Nor do we engage from the other side in offering food each day to those who depend on it for their sustenance, cultivating the wholesome, open, connected, light and joyous heart of generosity in the process. Yes, and so it seems in Israel as well. Our cultures encourage us to yearn for, to thirst for, to acquire, to accumulate, and then to fixate, to cling on our various accumulations, material accumulations and the accumulations of ideas, of opinions, and in the various views that support the whole materialistic culture. And then, in turn, we're deeply conditioned to identify ourselves outwardly and inwardly through all of our accumulations, material and otherwise, to think, to feel, and then to project that this is who we are, who I am. Many, many cultures, this is the primary aspect of many, many cultures, particularly in Europe and the U.S. And it seems so here, as far as I can tell. In the light of this very pervasive and very sticky conditioning, I think that it takes a certain kind of courage. A certain kind of courage to enter into a spiritual path that encourages us to towards seeing and knowing the truth of ourselves, the truth of all things underneath and beyond all of this training, this conditioning of attachment, this conditioning and training of clinging and identification. A poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. It's from a book called Different Ways to Pray. And she wrote this poem in Colombia in 1978. And she calls it Kindness. Before you know what kindness is, you must lose everything. Feel the past and the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened breath. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. you must see how this could be you, and how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head out of the crowd of the world to say, "It is you, it is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. I think that we don't really have anything truly integrated into our cultures that teaches and deepens us into living the truth of interconnectedness and the essential emptiness of all accumulations, material and otherwise. And I think that there's quite a profound loss in this lack. The practice and the development of the heart of generosity is the seed, it's the foundation of spiritual development. Generosity is the ground of love, compassion, and joy. It's a requisite. It's required towards the realization of liberation. This develops and our discerning capacity grows, and the heart, the mind, begins to touch, to know more and more deeply the undependability, the unsureness, the ephemerality, the changing nature, the impermanence, the anicca nature of all things in this world. We begin to really see this more and more clearly as our practice develops and deepens. What we think is ours today might be taken away tomorrow, or maybe seemingly belong to someone else next week. Even in this retreat, my spot, my chair in the meditation hall, my cushion, my seat in the dining room. What in this world really belongs to us? What can we really possess? Is there anything that really has any hard and fast owners? Everything constantly changes hands, or just simply dissolves. When we begin to touch this truth, it can be a very powerful factor that inclines us towards cultivating an inner wealth. The inner wealth of the qualities such as generosity, compassion, mindfulness, patience, loving kindness, joy, equanimity. An inner wealth of generosity is a very powerful medicine. It's an antidote to the anguish and the confusion that's generated through the conditioning, through the training of accumulating and then fixing on our accumulations. It is the natural, healthy, awakened response to the deepening understanding that there's nothing that can be held onto. Nothing in this constantly changing world. Our inner wealth, we could say, of generosity is a wealth that can never be depleted. It's a gift that can forever be given. And it's this seamless circle. It feeds itself. It grows itself. And so from this perspective, as the Buddha tells us, the greatest gift is the act of giving itself. Traditionally, in the teachings of the Buddha, there are three kinds of giving that are spoken of. And there's what's been called beggarly giving, which is when you give with only one hand. You know, symbolically, only one hand, still holding on to what we have to give. It's still mine. How I actually first started to give my young Chinese friend my bracelet. And in this kind of giving, we often give the least of what we have, and then afterwards we might even wonder whether we should have given at all. The second kind of giving is called friendly giving. So we give open-handedly, with both hands. And we take what we have and we share it. Because it seems, because it feels appropriate. It's a clear giving. And then there's what's been called queenly or kingly giving. And this is when we give really the best of what we have, even if nothing remains for ourselves. And we give the best of what we have instinctively. We give it graciously. And we know ourselves, we really know ourselves to be only temporary caretakers of whatever has been provided. We know ourselves as owning nothing. And in this, actually, there's no giving. It's just the spaciousness which allows objects and our caring heart to remain in the natural flow of life. The heart of generosity, the heart of wisdom. Probably needless to say, we don't always live with the purity of queenly and kingly generosity. And I think, in part, that's why we practice. That's why we're here. One of the reasons why we practice. There's a practice that comes from the Tibetans. It's a very basic practice for people who are extremely stingy, people who are very miserly, people who maybe identify themselves as being fiercely independent. People like this often have trouble giving maybe even to themselves and are often not easily able to ask for, not easily able to receive help, gifts, praise, and even love. They may not have the open-heartedness to give or receive with gratitude, with joy, with appreciation, with kindness. They may not be able to ask for help and to receive it graciously if it's given, even if they're sick physically or if they're distressed emotionally. So this practice is to take something very, very ordinary, something maybe like a potato or a turnip, and to hold it in one hand and then to pass it to the other hand and then to pass it back to the other hand and to pass it to the other hand, back and forth and back and forth until it gets easy. And then, if one's inclined, interested, there are the higher practices. Continue the practice of generosity. One moves on to seemingly more valuable objects, either metaphorically or literally. And the giving symbolically develops into letting go of, or relinquishing, or offering everything. All of the accumulations. The outer material accumulations and the inner accumulations of habits, preferences, ideas, beliefs, etc. And it's even spoken of in this practice of relinquishing the secret holdings, whatever those might be. In its final stage, the practice is ideally done with a mound of precious jewels that are symbolically offered over and over and over and over again to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the Sangha, and to all beings everywhere. So it's offered in a mandala form, and until they're all gone, and then you dump it all out and you start all over again. You keep doing it over and over and over. At one point in my years of practice, I did this practice. But instead of precious jewels, I used rice, which seemed very appropriate. See what we're doing. This is really what we're doing in our practice here. Without all of the paraphernalia. What's that word in Hebrew? Mm-hmm. Without all that stuff. Learning to give and learning to receive. Letting go of control and receiving what's given. Receiving each moment of our life just as it is, whether it's pleasant, whether it's unpleasant. With the trust that it's just right, just enough for our spiritual growth to unfold from. Ourselves the gift of truly learning to be in the present moment with a kind heart, with an open heart, and with a clear mindful awareness, receiving the present moment with gratitude, with appreciation, with humility, and with equanimity. We're learning to apply the unconditional acceptance of metta and the wise attention of mindful awareness in the midst of any exchange, any relationship, any emotional state, any sensation that moves through our body, any task that we might be engaged in. Like the Bodhisattva Sumedha, who with such great dedication and open-heartedness practiced and learned, we're also learning to receive life fully. Be kind, grateful, generous, knowing that this very life is the path, our path, to the deepest ease of well-being and joy. We too, like the Bodhisattva Sumedha, are learning that this very life is our path to liberation, and that our liberation is intimately and profoundly connected to the development of a deep generosity. Someone once asked Gandhi, who I think of as a bodhisattva of our time, "Why do you give so much? Why do you serve all these people?" And maybe surprisingly, Gandhi answered, "I don't give to anyone. I do it all for myself." The aim and the fruit of generosity is twofold. We give to help others and to free others, and we give to help and to free ourselves. This is really the fullness, the seamless circle of generosity. Through our practice, the energy of it grows and flows within us and from us. And we begin to know it and to live it quite naturally as who we are. End the talk with a story, another story. About 25 years ago, along with my interest in Buddhism, I had a Native American teacher whose name was Wallace Black Elk. And in those years, he would come once or twice a year to the area in Michigan where I lived to teach us. And one particular year, I invited him to come and stay in my house, a small, very old five-room log house in the middle of the Michigan forest, wooded area. And at that point, there were two of us living there, one of my sons and I. So the summer afternoon came when Wallace arrived. And a very old and very well-used small car pulled up into the driveway. And Wallace was the first one to get out. And he's quite a big man. He's probably 6 feet, 3 or 4 inches tall. And I don't know how that translates into meters, but or whatever it is, but he's a big, big person. And he's very big boned, and he looked even bigger because he wears big cowboy boots and a big, tall cowboy hat. So he got out first, and then it was like one of, I don't know, in we have circuses where there's a car parked in the middle of the ring and people keep getting out of it. Well, it was kind of like that. Because people kept getting out of this little car, and we were amazed watching. We watched seven people come out of this little car. All of Wallace's helpers and some members of his family. It turned out that there were 11 people living in our house during this 10-day period. That's how long he was there for, or they were there for. And I thought when everybody was there at first, I thought, how will we all live in this house? How will we all sleep? Where will we sleep in this tiny house? The space seemed to expand. People were sleeping everywhere. And food arrived. People would drop by in the afternoon to meet with and listen to Wallace as he talked and shared his, in a very casual way, his earth wisdom, Native American earth wisdom. So there were sometimes many people in the house. At night, Wallace and his extended family led ceremonies and practices in a sweat lodge that we had built, which was down the road at an ecology center that I was involved with. And usually those ended about 12:30 or 1 o'clock, 12:30 at night, 1 o'clock in the morning. And that's when it was time for dinner, because we weren't to eat before going into the sweat lodge. You're not supposed to have, it's not good to have a lot of food inside. So there weren't any meals taken in the afternoon or the evening. During those whole 10 days, I had to let go of many of my preferences, many of my habits, how I use the various spaces of my house, my usual schedule, the rhythm of my life, my food preferences, and various other preferences. Wallace and one of the other members of his family were smoked cigarettes. They were chain smokers, continuously smoking. I couldn't tell them they couldn't, because otherwise they would never be able to be in the house. So they were smoking all day long in the house. I didn't let people smoke in my house up until then, and not afterwards either. And of course, as I mentioned, people slept all over the house, everywhere. The day would begin quite late in the morning because of the late night sweat lodges and dinner, the 1 a.m. dinner. And as I said, every day in the afternoon, the house was filled with many people. Sometimes 15 or 20 people would come by to listen to Wallace as he shared the teachings in his kind of casual, conversational way. And somehow there was always enough food. We'd come back from the sweats at night, and there were dishes and bowls of food at the door or on the counter inside. And often a friend who was staying there, one of the people that was helping, and I would be cooking up something at midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning for our main meal of the day. And as I said, always enough food and, amazingly, always enough space. The last night of this whole event, Wallace and his friends and his family said that they wanted to do a ceremony, a ceremony of gratitude for my son and I. And they wanted to do it inside in our house, in the living room. So we all sat in a circle in the living room. And each one of us was asked to offer some words from our heart in relationship to the 10 days we'd spent together. So everyone did that. And then they gave my son and I these beautiful treasures, gifts that they had brought with them in gratitude for our sharing of our space, our time, and our energy with them. And then Wallace spoke, and he said that if one shares from the heart, shares material possessions, there will always be enough, abundance. He said if one shares one's space, time, and energy, he said it's an open-ended flow. He said there's no boundary, no frame on what's available in these areas. He said if one shares from the heart, it's in this that one receives everything. Simply in giving, there's abundance. One left that day, that last day, in seeing them off. My son and I stood outside watching them all going back into the old car. We both talked afterwards and said it felt like watching a movie backwards. And then the two of us walked back into our house and stood there looking around kind of amazed. The great seeming expanse of the house holding all of the people, all of the activity, all of the energy of those 10 days. As we walked back in after everyone left, it seemed as if our house shrunk and got smaller. And yet somehow internally, both of us felt very expanded. The amazing, powerful medicine of generosity. Practice, as you've all so diligently been engaged in over these days, a greatness of heart grows. It grows and flows within us as naturally as rivers flow in this world. As our heart opens and understanding wisdom deepens and matures, there's an easing of the constrictive thoughts, the constrictive feelings and actions of self-centeredness. And an ease, a joy, and a peace shows up as our experience in this life more and more often. And I'm closing the talk with a quote from a man named Russell Swikart. Russell Swikart was an astronaut some years ago. And there is a book that I think is out of print now, but a very beautiful book of photographs taken by various astronauts from different parts of the world and quotes from each of them. And this particular quote is from this man named Russell Swikart from that book. And these are his words. You recall staring out there at the spectacle that went before your eyes, because now you're no longer inside something with a window looking out at a picture. Now you're out there, and there are no frames, there are no limits, there are no boundaries. You're really out there, going 17,000 miles an hour, ripping through space, a vacuum. And there's not a sound. There's a silence, the depth of which you've never experienced before. And that silence contrasts so markedly with the scenery you're seeing and with the speed with which you know you're moving. And you think about what you've experienced and why. Do you deserve this fantastic experience? Have you earned this in some way? Are you separated out to be touched by God, to have some special experience that others can't have? And you know that the answer to that is no. There's nothing you've done to deserve this, to earn this. It's not a special thing for you. And you know very well at that moment, And then it comes through to you so powerfully that you're the sensing element for humans. You look down and see the surface of that globe that you lived on all this time. And you know all those people down there. And they are like you. And they are you. And somehow you represent them. You're up here as the sensing element, that point out on the end. And that's a humbling feeling. It's a feeling that says you have a responsibility. It's not for yourself. The eye that doesn't see doesn't do justice to the body. That's why it's there. That's why you're out there. And somehow you recognize that you're a piece of this total life. And that you're out there on that forefront and you have to bring it back somehow. And that becomes a rather special responsibility. And it tells you something about your relationship with this thing we call life. So that's a change. That's something new. And when you come back, there's a difference in that world now. There's a difference in that relationship between you and that planet and you and all those other forms of life on that planet, because you've had that kind of experience. It's a difference, and it's so precious. And let's sit for a few moments.